We're ready to move ahead to the third matter on today's calendar. I see council are entering and getting settled into council table. Please go ahead and do that. I'll ask the marshal to call the third case, but you can go ahead and organize your materials and get settled. So marshal, please call the third case.
Calling A231966 in the matter of the welfare of MVR child.
And I'll make just a few quick remarks. Appellant, you can go ahead, counsel, and stand there if you'd like. And sometimes it makes it easier for me to make the remarks, which is just to call your attention that the podium's adjustable, right? The height goes up and down. Microphone can be moved around. Please get comfortable. Note that you've got a clock as well on the podium, and that will count down so you know how much time you have remaining. It tends to go quickly once we get engaged. And at the very beginning of your remarks, if you would please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. What we're trying to do is have a clear record. This audio recording to today's argument is later posted on the court's website, and that just keeps everything very clear for us. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Sean McCarthy. I appear this morning on behalf of appellant Rice County, the state of Minnesota. This matter involves a 16-year-old who committed a felony third-degree crim sex assault against a 13-year-old victim. It's a presumptive commit to prison. And importantly, the legislature has determined that there is no statute of limitations on a crim sex third-degree felony. The trial court's order in this case effectively imposes a statute of limitations if you're a juvenile crim sex offender. There's no difference between the adult criminal rule for dismissal, Rule 30.02, and the juvenile rule 6.08. They both use the same key language. Respondent seems to argue, well, the juvenile rule doesn't mention any need to show prejudice. The adult rule doesn't require that either. And in fact, the cases interpreting the adult rule, Banks, Lusher, FCR, those cases cited in appellant's brief, they impose a requirement that in order to gain a dismissal by the trial court, there needs to be a showing of prejudice.
What type of showing of prejudice is required in those cases?
Typically, it's either some abuse of discretion in the charging process itself, or some delay that causes a tactical advantage, or another alternative to a showing of prejudice in those kinds of cases is if it causes some harm to the defense, some specific harm in your ability to defend the case itself. Notably, Lusher notes that sentencing impact, change in sentencing option, even a longer sentence, that is speculative. The kind of prejudice they're looking for is there some harm to the defense, such as loss of witnesses or loss of ability to defend oneself?
Before we dive further into the prejudice question, I just want to be clear. Was it an abuse of discretion for the district court, from your perspective, to conclude that there was unnecessary delay in charging? Because I note in your brief you dive in, as you are here, into the prejudice issue. Do you agree that you're not appealing on those grounds, right?
Well, I think what Your Honor is asking is, am I saying that there was an abuse of discretion here? Yes, that's what I'm saying.
For the district court to conclude that there was an unnecessary delay in charging, as opposed to, and then there, then if even if there was, there has to be prejudice, is what I read your brief as saying. But I just wanted to clarify that with you.
Pre-charge delay is the key concept here. Is that what the court's getting at? The pre-charge delay?
Was there an unnecessary delay in charging?
Correct. That's the state would. The state would argue, no, there was not an unnecessary delay. Important distinction here, the two-year delay argued in respondent's brief, that's a red herring. We didn't have a BCA DNA match until only 7 months before the charging happened.
Why did you need a BCA DNA match? As I understand the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, the complaining witness reported the crime, identified the perpetrator, and the police were able to confirm her identification through text messages or Snapchat or whatever it is the kids do. And so the police knew who the person was. Why couldn't it have been charged immediately and then proceeded with DNA testing after that? That often happens in criminal cases. It seems that a choice was made to delay charging until BCA results were obtained. Did you have to wait for BCA results?
No prosecutor would necessarily have to, but in the modern age, that becomes the defense at trial and becomes another pretrial motion you have to deal with. We don't even have a BCA match here. This is premature, it's inappropriate, but or it becomes a theory of the case.
Yeah, here's the problem. We are, in fact, dealing with a juvenile, and the laws are different, and the procedure is different. If you are dealing with someone who's accused of committing an offense as an adult, you know, the sentencing possibilities or the dispositional options aren't going to change. But here they change in the juvenile context. So isn't that something that has to be taken into consideration when you're looking at unnecessary delay in charging?
I agree that that's a factor that the court and this panel can consider. It's not the sole factor. And the reason I'm here on this appeal is because on this case, the complete dismissal of the case results in no sex offender treatment, no counseling, no probation services, no supervision, no punishment, no consequences, and a victim who has absolutely no outcome.
Well, one might respond that, well, if you had charged it immediately when you knew what the allegation was and you knew who the alleged perpetrator was, those things could have been addressed, and instead we had 2 years where nothing happened.
Well, I would argue that it wasn't 2 years where nothing happened. The first go-round at BCA was just getting the DNA results from the one subject.
Well, what was the
match
length of
is the
time
second.
Between the report of the crime and charging?
So, the report of the crime and charging?
Yes.
That's closer to the two-year time frame. I don't have the exact dates.
Okay, so yeah. The alleged offense date was July 8, 2021. The charging date was June 20th. 2023.
Yep, I agree with the court on that. I'm still arguing this case, though, Your Honor, because the reality for prosecutors is they have a duty to make charging decisions with the right level of consideration for both the impact on the defendant. This is a third-degree crim sex case.
Okay,
why not get your DNA locked down? Plus, that's an issue that juries are all over right now. It's a reality for trial lawyers. You got to factor that in.
But the prosecutor makes the choice to delay charging, in this case nearly 2 years, because the state wants to have a DNA match before charging. We can't ignore the effect of that decision, which is 2 years have now been lost, during which time there could have been opportunities within the juvenile court system to provide sex offender treatment, avoid adult criminal conviction, avoid the possibility of a prison sentence. I mean, how do we balance that?
That comes into play in every single case, Your Honor. The key here is the Minnesota Supreme Court said in FCR, the choice about what to charge and when to charge is entitled to substantial deference on review. That is a prosecution function. We get into separation of powers concerns.
What to charge, but just when to charge. And you can charge whenever you want. There's no statute of limitation. But then, given this rule and given another statute, do you risk losing a case because you waited too long to charge? For example, in addition to this rule, 260B193, which governs dispositions, and more generally, there's a section stuck in here about juvenile court jurisdiction, which is really out of place, but an important one. And what that says is the district court has original exclusive jurisdiction over a proceeding. Oops, sorry, I've got to back up. Right statute, wrong portion. Oh, gosh. I apologize. The juvenile court has jurisdiction to over an offense which was alleged to have been committed before an offender's 18th birthday. The juvenile court has jurisdiction over that now 18-year-old or more adult for the purpose of having a certification proceeding to get the adult to adult court, unless The adult demonstrates that the delay was purposefully caused by the state in order to gain an unfair advantage. So it's like the legislature's already sort of indicated that it's aware of these circumstances where, you know, charging decisions might impact the availability of resources to a juvenile, and has made a decision that, well, if there is delay and it's inexcusable, the juvenile court doesn't even have jurisdiction to transfer the case to adult court pursuant to the certification motion you filed. So, I mean, I'm just point that out in response to the argument that, well, the prosecution can wait as long as it wants to charge its case and make sure it has the best case, and there is, you know, no downside for the state. I think there could be a downside, and this case maybe shows an example of a potential downside, which is you waited too long to charge and change the procedural posture or impacted the procedural posture of a case in a way that negatively affected the juvenile, now adult.
And has the court finished the question?
Yeah, I guess that wasn't much of a question,
that's okay.
Was it?
I get it. That's the nature of these conversations. And, Your Honor, I respect where you're coming from. And I acknowledge that there are consequences for a juvenile in terms of fewer options available. But most important here, those options didn't reduce until after we had the best evidence to go forward to trial with, the BCA match. You've already heard that point.
Best evidence, not the only evidence. I mean, if
I agree.
You were here saying, look, if we would have charged this, we'd have got kicked out on probable cause, that's a better argument. But, I mean, there are plenty of crim sex cases where there is no DNA evidence, and plenty of case law saying a crim sex conviction can be upheld based upon the testimony of a single complaining witness that's been determined to be credible. So it's not a situation where you couldn't charge or it's the weakest case we've ever seen. It's you wanted to wait till you had all your ducks in order, and that took 2 years.
And while I hear and respect what the court is saying, part of the problem there is the trial lawyer is then going to face a whole range of other challenges at the omnibus stage, challenges from an evidentiary stage, waiting to get your ducks in a row on a serious crim sex that's a presumptive commit.
That's
the prosecutor's discretionary choice, and that discretionary choice should be given some deference. And here, I think the most delay we get out of this is the 7 months from when the DNA match comes in until after.
Factoring, why is that the most delay?
That's reasonable. Where's the prejudice to the defense, except for the sentencing options, which, again, I'd say that the sentencing options, this is
Stop, please. Sentencing options. You're citing adult criminal case law when you're talking about sentencing options, yes?
I misspoke. Dispositional options for a juvenile.
Okay. And are you saying the dispositional options don't matter for a juvenile?
The dispositional options do matter, but he turned 18 before we had the BCA
but I'm
match.
Looking at it this way. The date of the offense, July 8th, 2021. He was 16 years old and 8 months. He had at that time 4 years and 4 months before he would become age 21. That matters because the state had filed a presumptive certification motion. Even though it was a presumptive motion, the juvenile had the opportunity to contest it, to have a hearing before the district court, at which time the district court would have to decide whether the juvenile had met his burden to show that the case could be retained under juvenile court jurisdiction, extended juvenile jurisdiction, based on the factors, the public safety factors that determine certification. And two of those factors, the fifth and sixth, are the amount of time remaining to treat the juvenile and the dispositional options available to the juvenile. And we've got case law saying when you're deciding whether or not to certify, you know, we routinely, and it is appropriate to look at, well, how much time is left before the juvenile turns 21? How much time would we have with EJJ jurisdiction as opposed to certification? And where I'm seeing prejudice here, if prejudice is indeed required, is that if this had been charged during the summer of 2021, it was reported the next day, the perpetrator identified the next day, the perpetrator's identity confirmed by the police within days, within a week. If it had been charged then, This juvenile would have had around 4 years plus a few days left under EJJ jurisdiction, and he would have been, you know, under 17, making all sorts of programs available to him that were no longer available to him once it was charged, because when he was charged, he was now 18 years and 7 months, pretty close to 19, where you age out of most juvenile programming options, and there are only 2 years and 5 months left until age 21, so a much shorter time of probation. So to me, it seems that there was some prejudice resulting to the juvenile as a result of the state's discretionary decision. You're entitled to decide to wait to charge until you have the DNA, but that 2-year wait does seem to have prejudiced this juvenile in terms of the outcome of this case.
Key here is, and again, with all respect to the court, most of what the court just said is focusing in on and trying to second guess what the prosecutor did. That's not deference to the prosecutor's discretionary factor.
I defer to the prosecutor. The prosecutor was well within his or her right and reason to wait 2 years. But what I'm asking is, given that deference, I'm not willing to defer to the point where we say, well, then we don't care if a juvenile is prejudiced. And the legislature is not willing to do that either, because as I said, 260B, 193, subdivision 5, termination of jurisdiction, says that when you have a circumstance where a prosecutor charges someone who's now over the age of 18 for a felony committed under the age of 18, the juvenile court has jurisdiction to designate the proceeding EJJ prosecution or to certify the juvenile unless it's demonstrated that the delay was purposefully caused by the state in order to gain an unfair advantage. So I'm just suggesting that your deference, you're entitled to charging deference, but it's without consequence. Because even the legislature has said, you know, well, if you decide to wait because you want to get an unfair advantage, the juvenile court doesn't even have jurisdiction to do anything with the case.
My time is up. May I respond to the question, or would the panel like to save that for rebuttal?
No, please respond to the question briefly. And you, of course, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure. The key here is the cases on dismissals by the court for pre-charging delay always focus on prosecutorial discretion getting some deference, and importantly, where's the prosecutor getting some benefit in proving the offense? Not in the sentencing or dispositional juvenile options, but in the tactical advantage in winning the case by harming the defense ability to defend against the case. In this case, the only showing we have of prejudice is the defendant's subjective feeling of stress because he committed a really serious offense and had serious consequences out there, and to the degree that there are some limited or a limitation of some of the dispositional options for a juvenile, I'll acknowledge that's a factor here. Why my argument is this goes too far on these facts, where you have a third-degree crim sex, presumptive commit to prison, and the complete dismissal of the case. The showing of prejudice that the case law in the adult rule context requires gives some boundaries to that instead of it being unfettered discretion by the trial court.
Yes, go right ahead. Yeah.
Just following up on that, so you're telling us there's got to be both substantial prejudice and improper motive, right?
Yes.
So did you argue the improper motive below, as you just did pretty eloquently here, because I didn't see that addressed in the district court's opinion?
My understanding is that there was no showing of any improper motive nor any analysis of it.
Does there need to be under the rule?
It's not written in the rule, but it's in the case law the exact same way that the prejudice is in the case law. And I'm saying this court should follow the same case law.
But you distinguish between substantial prejudice and improper motive in your briefing, and I'm just asking if you argue below that both needed to be present.
I will be honest. I don't know that off the top of my head. Distinction is there. Those are things that are addressed in different parts of the case law in the adult rule context. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we're ready for your respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Eriksson, and I represent the respondent this morning, MVR. We are requesting that this court affirm the juvenile court's order dismissing the charge and petition because the state has not established that the court abused its discretion. Specifically, the state has not pointed to a single legal error, a single erroneous factual finding, or articulated how the court's order was against logic. The court's order was not an abuse of discretion for three reasons. First, the court applied the plain language of Rule 6.08 and found that the delay was unnecessary because the state did not provide any explanation for the nearly two-year delay in charging, which included a seven-month delay following the completion of the state's investigation. Second, the court made accurate and thoughtful findings after observing live witness testimony from MVR and his mother. Specifically, the court concluded that the delay in charging MVR prejudiced him because it perpetuated his anxiety, disrupted his ability to pursue education, and limited the possible juvenile dispositions that would have been in the best interests of MVR as a juvenile. Finally, the court properly considered the motion in its order under the purpose of the juvenile justice system, specifically that the excessive delay undermined the purpose of the juvenile justice system, which is to provide a juvenile with access to opportunities for personal and social growth. In sum, because the state cannot establish that there was an abuse of discretion in this case, we are requesting that this court affirm the juvenile court's order. I would like to just jump right into what the state was discussing regarding what the standard is. The case the state cites to FCR is from 1979. That's a due process constitutional case. Lucier in 2005 is also a constitutional due process case. So the substantial prejudice and also improper state motive, that's in the constitutional context. In Banks, which is what the state relies on, it's never mentioned. Not once. That's not the standard that was applied in Banks. It wasn't substantial prejudice and didn't require an improper state motive. It was only, the court did find that prejudice needed to be proved, but those other two prongs were not involved in Banks because that was under the rules of criminal procedure and not a constitutional argument. So even though it's in the state's headings in one of the sections of the brief that under Banks, this is the standard, that's not the standard from Banks under the rule. I'd also like to touch on this issue of the getting the DNA. It's important to note that the record establishes that the DNA, there was not a application for a warrant for the DNA until May of 2022. So this idea that the state needed to get the DNA for its prosecution, as Judge Larkin was discussing, they certainly could have gotten a warrant a day or two, a week, a month, 6 months after the incident when they had information of who the person was, where they lived, they had made contact with his mother, and they did not attempt to get a warrant for his DNA.
When did they get the warrant?
May of 2022, which is, my math, 9 to 10 months after the allegation, or 11 months.
And when did they have contact with the juvenile and or his mother?
A week after the incident, a week or two after the incident. Within 24 hours, the state had his identity, had the text messages or Snapchat messages from the phone, and also had surveillance video from the apartment complex that showed that he was there. I've handled a lot of very serious criminal sexual conduct cases in the adult context, and that's a lot of evidence to establish at least probable cause to get a search warrant and to get a criminal complaint. As far as the prosecutor having discretion to charge, I think that's one thing that's missing is that the purpose of the juvenile system, and that has to be considered in charging as well. It's not just on review when we're looking at cases. It's every decision the state makes when they're determining whether to charge a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old with a serious offense like this. They have to consider what was discussed earlier, that it's in the what's in the best interest of the child for his future, all of the considerations that are in the, that the legislature has articulated and that the rule has articulated in Rule 1. And in this case, the idea that the state can just delay charging to gain a tactical advantage, which is what the state just admitted, to bolster their prosecution and hurt the defense, that seems to be quite contrary to the rules of juvenile procedure and what the intent is behind those rules. I also want to reiterate this court's decision in CSN, which was also a criminal sexual conduct case that involved a serious allegation where this court determined in a different context that a certain amount of delay does prejudice a juvenile. And that's the same in this case, that, you know, when incidents do happen, it's important that the state respond right away so the individual can get the services that he or she needs in order to become a better citizen in our society and to maybe fix the issues that resulted in the criminal conduct. In our argument, I want to make clear that I made the argument that the state or that the defense does not need to show prejudice. I stand by that argument, and I think that's an important consideration by this court. But prejudice was clearly established. I don't want that to get lost in my argument. The fact that there's live testimony establishing that he did have anxiety, and while he did suffer from anxiety prior to this incident, it was perpetuated, and it became worse, and it resulted in him dropping out of college. So in contrast to Banks, where I don't think there was any showing of prejudice, I don't think there were any facts on the record here that it was well established that there was prejudice through the anxiety, but also as Judge Larkin was discussing what the dispositional options were in this case, and that by the time that these charges were imposed, there was little that could happen in his case to deal with him as a juvenile and to give him the opportunity to figure out what led to the criminal conduct.
Mr. Erickson, did you argue below for the district court that prejudice wasn't required?
No. I was not the trial attorney, but it was not the, and I think it was necessary to argue under Banks below because you got to establish everything you possibly can at that. Now that we're at the Court of Appeals and we're making this argument, I think we can really look at what the rule says, and I feel like I can make this argument here. But at that point, there would be no advantage for them to say, we don't have to show prejudice, we're not going to have testimony, we're not going to establish this, when they clearly could. So I don't think that gets in the way of what our argument is here today. One other thing I just want to mention, if the court doesn't have any questions for me, is that the Supreme Court's recent decision in DJFD regarding interpreting the rules of juvenile procedure differently than the rules of criminal procedure, even if it's the exact same language and it's identical, that this court needs to consider the rules under Rule 1 and the purpose. And I think that's really important that the rule of criminal procedure doesn't control in this case. And while this is an issue in first impression for this court, I think it's more important to rely on the purpose of the juvenile rules than it is to rely on the rule of criminal procedure. So if the court doesn't have any questions,
if we were to conclude that delay is required or prejudice is required, what would you argue the prejudice is here?
The proven anxiety of the delay in charging, the fact that he was unable or he had to drop out of school, and all the dispositional limitations that resulted. As Your Honor was discussing, if he would have been charged when he was 16 years old, when the state had probable cause to charge him, there could have been a lot of intervention with the juvenile as far as EJJ, as far as other juvenile dispositions, continuance for dismissal. There are all sorts of options at that point where the county attorney and the defense attorney and the judge could have worked together to make sure he had all the resources he needed at that time. And there is a very strong showing of increased anxiety. He was dealing with seizures. And of course, anyone who is facing a criminal charge is gonna be anxious. But the facts proven here establish more than that, that this was a young kid who was dealing with something where he had no idea that this charge was gonna come down, and when it came down, it destroyed his life. And I understand that there's a victim and there's both sides of this, but we are in the juvenile justice system where we need to consider the juvenile, even though he is the criminal defendant.
Well, that raises an interesting point because one might argue that it's a disservice to the victim to wait 2 years to charge a case because nothing's happening from the victim's perspective.
Right, and I agree with that. And I think when we're in the juvenile system, it is a more holistic approach to all the parties involved. And that could not happen in this case, especially if the purpose was for some tactical advantage. I mean, again, between the delay, that 7-month delay, there is no articulation of why that delay took place. Could have clearly been charged in November of 2022 after that DNA result came back, and that didn't happen, and the state didn't even attempt to establish why that delay from November to June took place. So we request that this court affirm the juvenile court's order.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May I begin?
You may.
In rebuttal, the state would emphasize that no showing of a tactical advantage being taken by the state in this case, no showing of improper motive, and in fact, a case timeline of charging like this for a third-degree crim sex is a felony, which is a presumptive commit, that's fairly normal in the world of crim sex cases. The difference here is it's a juvenile.
Presumptive commit if you get him to adult court.
Correct.
And you greatly improved your ability to get him to adult court as a result of the two-year charging delay.
And again, with all due respect, I would argue that there is no showing in this record that that was done on purpose or improper motive.
Does the rule require it to be done on purpose? And I apologize for citing the statute, which does talk about showing purposeful delay, but that's a different statute. That's a statute saying the district court or juvenile court doesn't have jurisdiction at all. So we require this showing in that circumstance. No one was arguing here that the juvenile court didn't have jurisdiction. People here relied on a rule that authorizes a dismissal. So,
and the key here is that rule, the juvenile rule 6.08, there's no cases interpreting it. Both sides agree to that. This panel knows that. I'm here asking this court to apply some interpretation to rule 6.08, and it should be similar to, not identical, but similar to the adult rule. There should be a showing of prejudice, okay, and factors such as prosecutorial improper motive are relevant factors. I think the court
I'm looking at Banks, and I'm not seeing that improper motive was listed as a requirement there. It was just there has to be some prejudice.
The cases Banks relies upon include Lusher, which includes improper motive. The cases Banks relies, the problem is there's not a lot of case law on this particular area. There's zero in the juvenile rule. And in the adult rule, there's some. In fact, it was the defense below. The court asked me earlier if, you know, what was argued below. The defense was the one citing the Banks because it was the closest thing anybody could find. I'm asking this court to let's clarify this juvenile rule that has no interpretation yet. And there should be, at a minimum, some kind of showing of prejudice. And this court has the option to look at the history of that prejudice. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If the court were to believe that there has to be some showing of prejudice, your position is the prejudice of the lost dispositional options is not adequate?
On these facts, I'm arguing, and I recognize there can be a difference of opinion here, but my argument is that the loss of dispositional options on this particular case should not be weighted as heavily against the state as the court was seeming to argue it, because another factor there is getting the DNA match for a conclusive case. Court may disagree with me on that.
So your argument is our delay was reasonable because we wanted the DNA match.
That's a reasonable factor.
And the district court concluded it was not reasonable.
Correct. Other factors that could come into play. I don't know in this particular case, but I lay this out because we're having this discussion about where should this rule go to interpret it. And I want to assist the court in thinking about those factors.
Can I make a suggestion? Perhaps this rule should go back to the Rules Committee, and instead of us trying to decide what the Rules Committee met, and apparently I was the chair of the committee when this rule was adopted, and I don't remember adopting it, which tells me, based on memory alone, that it wasn't controversial and it was just something that we modeled after the criminal rule. Why wouldn't we perhaps just say the Rules Committee should take a look at this? Why would we substitute our judgment about what the Rules Committee intended when you've got the chair of the committee on the panel and she doesn't remember what the intent was? Might it be a better approach to let the Rules Committee sort this out, and then their decision would have to be approved by the Supreme Court, which would trump whatever we said here today?
This court could make that recommendation regardless of the outcome of the case. And in fact, that might be a good recommendation if the court feels that's appropriate for the Rules Committee to consider.
If we felt there was enough prejudice to justify. If we were to say, well, even if there needs to be prejudice, there's enough prejudice here.
That's something that the court could do. And in particular, again, what I'm kind of suggesting is the juvenile rule currently has no boundaries, no constraints whatsoever. And the adult rule does. There's no difference in the key language. I acknowledge counsel's argument, and the panel has commented that the juvenile rules are different than the criminal rules. But just because they're different doesn't mean you should be able to completely dismiss a third-degree crim sex with no other option, no more intermediate step, and not even any analysis of the level.
There is a statute, I believe, that allows a district court to dismiss a case in the interest of justice. What does that case law tell us about whether there needs to be prejudice or how we review such a decision?
Don't know that off the top of my head, Your Honor, but the analysis of my time has run up. But thank you, Your Honors.
Oh, go ahead and answer the question, Counsel.
My argument in response or my analysis would be interests of justice is where we get into those things that I started with at the very beginning. We have no punishment, no supervision, no services, no justice for the victim. I acknowledge some of those arguments go both ways, but right now we've got a rule that has no boundaries whatsoever. Trial judges are in the Wild West. They can do what they want. This panel should at least impose some of those concepts from the adult rule. This is a good case to do it, and it's got the right consequences at play. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing from you today and having the opportunity to discuss the issues. The matter is now submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. So thank you for that. With that, we have concluded the matters on our oral argument calendar, and we will be in recess for our non-oral calendar. Thank you. All right.